Good afternoon, everybody. Stefan Mullen, Free Domain. Hope you're doing well. And please help support the show, freedomain.com/donate. These are questions from Facebook. Is the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde an allegory for alcoholism? I don't think so. So I'm sure, as you know, this is a novella written by Robert Louis Stevenson, maybe based on a friend of his or an acquaintance of his who seemed outwardly normal, but actually killed his wife by poisoning her with opiates. And it is about an upright lawyer who is a secret killer. So I don't think it's about alcoholism. I think it's about two things. Number one is that conformity breeds rage. Forcing people to conform breeds resentment and anger. Censorship breeds rebellion, repression breeds revolution. And so pushing down personalities, pushing down aspects of yourself breeds rebellion. Now, we all have an aggressive side, and we should, because there are a-holes out in the world who will strip us of our rights and liberties and property and freedoms and families. And like, there are people who will do all of that, and we need to be able to get angry and fight where necessary. Now, society, when it becomes over-aggressive, dissolves into chaos and warlords and totalitarianism and all kinds of messy stuff. But when society gets too conformist, then progress tends to stop. It's kind of like evolution, right? Evolution needs a couple of random genes in order to progress. And without those random genes, things don't progress. But too many random genes and the mutations are usually too strong for the organism to remain viable. So society as a whole needs its conformists and it needs its rebels. And society will try and turn every rebel into a conformist. And the rebels will rebel often against that. So I think it is about if you force a significantly aggressive nature, instead of harnessing that, in society to find some positive aspect to it, maybe a soldier or a boxer or, you know, something where maybe even a very aggressive business man or woman, usually man. But society needs to find a way to harness aggression rather than just shaming men for being aggressive, you know, toxic masculinity and all this kind of stuff. Like the fact that we have that, but no conversations about toxic femininity shows you just how completely one-sided and lopsided these conversations are. So if you force too much conformity in society, there's going to be a rebellion against that conformity, and there should be. I'm not talking violence, I'm just talking about a rebellion against that conformity. And we can kind of see that happening right now. We have all of these, you know, very aggressive woke language scolds, and everyone's bad and phobic and racist, and everything is toxic and appropriated and all of that. So when the aggression of repression gets too great, then there is an explosion of anger. So when you have an outwardly mild and conformist person, there is another person in there who's the polar opposite. This is sort of a Jungian thing, the shadow self and so on. Polite people, like hyper-polite people, can be incredibly aggressive. And we can see this, of course, that the more that there's this focus on diversity of thought and toleration and openness, you can see the shadow side of those ideals being the, you know, fairly hysterical and wild aggression and deplatforming and violence and censorship. So as you push for more and more, quote, diversity, then you actually end up with less and less diversity. You end up with this sort of chilling uniformity. And so we can see this everywhere in society, right? That those who push for the most tolerance have as the underside or the superstructure of their belief systems, like sentimentality and cruelty often go hand in hand. People who start to become addicted to this idea of being sweet and nice and wonderful, and they get addicted to the feelings of virtue signaling, get very aggressive at people who point out that the virtue signaling is covering up massive dysfunctions and actually cruelties in society. So people who like, oh, you know, we need universal healthcare so that everyone gets healthcare. And then you point out that people aren't able to access healthcare, like in places here in Canada, you have to wait up to 2+ years to get a doctor, a family doctor. And a referral to a specialist, I think, is at 27 weeks now, which is, you know, it's over 6 months, right? So when people say, well, I just like the idea of everyone getting free healthcare, and then you point out, well, you're actually denying people a healthcare in many ways, they get angry because they want to feel good. So you see the supposed niceness when you point out that it isn't actually very nice and is actually harmful, then they get very aggressive, right? So people who are conformists have underneath that conformity and that mildness and that pleasantness, they have very wild hostility, aggression, and the capacity for significant or extreme violence at times, or at least a support for it, right? A support for it. And I mean, you can see this, you know, all the My Body, My Choice feminists and feminist allies didn't have much to say when women were forced to take, or I mean, yeah, virtually forced in many ways to take vaccines and so on, right? So it is a unconscious recognition of the very real fact that conformists are very aggressive. And so this guy in the story, who's very much a conformist, has a hidden side of aggression to him. And I think that the story picks that up very well. That's number one. And number two is that if you want to do evil, the best way to do it is to pretend to be good. And if you want to do evil, the best way to do it is to pretend to be good. And so on the one side of things, there is the sort of mild-mannered conformist main protagonist, right? And there is the underside of violence. Conformity is aggression, because how do you get people to conform as children, right? Society can't tell people how to be good because it doesn't really know how to be good. So all it can do is threaten children with aggression, spanking, rejection, violence, going to bed without supper, being forced to sit in a particular location and sort of the timeout stuff. So society can't teach people how to be good, I mean, until it accepts UPB, which will probably be at least 1 to 3 generations. Society can't teach people how to be good, so all it can do is threaten them. And so conformity results from threats, and that is why conformity has an understructure of violence underneath it, because conformity is enforced through violence and aggression and threats of ostracism and so on, which to children are threats of violence, of course. So that's on the one side. On the other side, if you want to be somebody who's not suspected of being evil, then you want to drape yourself in the mantle of virtue, right? It's the great question of the sort of woke movement that's going on. It's really not a very organic movement, but this woke movement is, are people genuinely, they want to do good in the world and they get frustrated and angry at those who disagree with them, or are the most efficient bullies those who cloak themselves in moral righteousness? In other words, do they want to be good but are frustrated, or do they want to be bullies? And the best way to do that is to take up this mantle of egalitarianism, right? Do, say, communists, do they just want a land of milk and honey and peace and reason for everyone, and they just get frustrated and angry at those who disagree with them and reluctantly turn to aggression or violence, as generally tends to be the case? Or is the best way to indulge your sadistic impulses to cloak yourself in an ideology that inevitably leads to mass violence, right? Are you a good person who descends into evil, or are you an evil person who pretends to be good? In other words, is the shadow side of the good person the evil side, or is the shadow side of the evil person, or the light side of the evil person, the pretense to virtue? So, I mean, sort of typical example of this is, say, the boomers. The boomers will say, you know, we care about our life, our society, we care about our children, you know, our children are everything to us, right? And then you say, well, then you have to give up some retirement benefits and healthcare benefits because there's not enough money to pay. And then they get very aggressive, right? So that's the shadow side. That's the shadow side. So I think the story goes quite deep into these issues. So, all right. How can we, the people, be held accountable for our complicity in the collapse of the Western world? We who stood by as we allowed them to sell our children's futures in $35 trillion in debt. All right, so we who spoke against the corrupt politicians and then obeyed them. Well, I mean, my case for 20 years is it's called the against me argument. And so you sit down and talk with, you know, friends and family, and you say, well, I don't support X, Y, or Z government action. And they say, well, I do support it. And then you say, well, do you support me being thrown in jail if I don't support it, right? And if they do support you being thrown in jail because you don't support X, Y, or Z program, then, like, let's say that if you say, I don't support, I don't know, foreign aid, right? Okay, then, but you would support me being thrown in jail if I don't pay for the foreign aid, right? That's sort of the question, right? And if people say yes, then I do support you being thrown in jail, or the welfare state. Like, I think the welfare state is toxic and destructive and harmful and immoral. Then would you allow me, or would you support me being able to withdraw from paying for that which violates my conscience, right? And if people say yes, you should be thrown in jail if you don't do what I want, that's immoral, and I personally don't associate with those kinds of people. It's a matter of basic elemental pride and self-respect. And so I think it was close to 20 years ago, I sort of introduced this argument to the world. And it's a way of making people take their beliefs seriously. See, people can mouth off whatever platitudes they want, but if they don't have any skin in the game, then the beliefs are not real. And they suffer no negative consequences. You know, I mean, the old sort of joke was, sort of a bitter, dark joke was, everybody who put the Ukrainian flag in their bio with this sort of Slava Ukraine kind of thing, that they would then be drafted to go and fight the war in Ukraine. Well, you can imagine how quickly those flags would come down. Or if they alone got a bill for the support of the war in Ukraine, if they alone got the bill, how quickly would that, you know, they would have said, okay, well, if you have the flag in your bio, then you got to pay $10,000 towards supporting the war in Ukraine. How many people would then take that down? And so, you know, one of the problems, of course, is that the people who are interested in freedom tend to be sort of very nice. And one of the reasons that we care about freedom is we have empathy to people, free will, choice, virtues, morality, and all of that kind of good stuff. And so we tend to try to reason with people. We don't like saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with you if you continue to want to force me to do things against my conscience. And I'm talking obviously completely peacefully and voluntary and so on. It's like the intervention thing, like someone has a terrible addiction and friends and family get together and say, you got to go and get help for this addiction or we're cutting you out of our lives, right? Now, very few, as far as I understand it, sort of very few libertarians have gone down that path. I really haven't heard of any, but I mean, outside of people who sort of listen to the philosophy that I put forward, I haven't really heard of any. But if you look at something like COVID, then the people who believed in the efficacy and necessity of the vaccines were absolutely willing to cut off family members who didn't get vaccinated, or even who opposed these sort of mandatory vaccine. So the people who were pro-vaccine were willing to ostracize family members. And I was reading this really, really sad history. I mentioned it on the show the other day. It was under a Naomi Wolf post on X. It's a very sad history of how much ostracism was going on over the course of the pandemic. So they were very serious about their beliefs and willing to sacrifice relationships for the sake of the vaccine. And so they'll win. And until we are willing to ostracize people whose beliefs are immoral, deeply immoral, and I don't mean like right away, you make the case. You may make the case for some weeks or possibly even months, though years seems a bit ridiculous. But at some point, you have to take your beliefs seriously. And my argument has been, if an action is defined as immoral, right? If an action is defined as immoral, then people who advocate that action in particular against you are immoral people. And of course, we try to help people who are immoral and we try to bring them to the light, but if they are steadfast in their immorality, then a moral person really can't hang out with them and retain integrity, right? An immoral person cannot remain in the social orbit forever of a moral person, and the moral person then still claims integrity. So you drop your morality after a certain amount of time, or you drop the relationship, or you accept that the morality doesn't really mean anything to you, it's just a pretense and so on, right? I mean, if morality doesn't inform you who you spend time with, then the morality doesn't make any sense. Morality, one of the things it should do is help define who you should spend time with. So for instance, obviously I am anti-spanking, right? Spanking is a violation of the non-aggression principle. Now, if I had a relative who not only spanked his children, but also advocated for it, was very prominent and positive about it, and constantly, you know, would post about the need for it and all of these kinds of things. So spanking is immoral. Now, I can understand that if you grew up this way, you know, it may take a little bit of time for you to see the immorality of it. But, you know, I would sit down with that person and say, okay, so this is your practice. Let me give you the moral arguments. Let me give you the consequentialist arguments. Let me give you the scientific arguments. You know, here's the lovely Dr. Elizabeth Gershoff to tell you about the meta-studies of spanking and how harmful spanking is to kids, like all of that sort of stuff. And then it comes down to a choice. If this family member or friend or whoever, even after being exposed to all of the rational and empirical and factual and scientific and consequentialist arguments, if this person still said, spanking is good, I don't care what you say, I'm going to hit my children and I'm going to publicly advocate for hitting children, well, that person, again, after a certain amount of time, you give a little bit of time for the shock to set in, for the change to occur, you give some grace. And I remember giving a speech about this exact topic and taking Q&As from the audience in the Libertarian Convention, I think it was out in California or something, in 2011, like, you know, 13 plus years ago. So would I sit down happily and break bread with somebody who hits his children even after I've explained all of the virtues, morals, and ethics of that? Would it be right and reasonable for me to sit down and expose my children to it and so on, right? What do my beliefs mean? What do moral beliefs mean if they don't change any of my actions, and in particular, my social actions, right? The moral beliefs would be just yapping, just noise. So if you have made the case for the non-aggression principle and you still have people in your life who want you thrown in jail for standing to or by your ethical beliefs, then you are responsible. And I've certainly made the case. So, all right. Do you enjoy Guinness beer? No, I don't. I don't really enjoy Guinness beer. You know, what if they'd hack me off a slice of Guinness? It's like if you carbonated bilge water and added some semi-toxic sludge to me, you would get a Guinness. It's not my thing. But then again, I'm not working in the fields and desperately need non-bacterial-based energy in the Middle Ages. So, all right, how do we regulate the kids' use of iPad? I mean, I think it's fine to give them some access to an iPad, but your challenge as a parent is to be more engaging and enjoyable than an iPad, right? So my daughter really enjoys river walks, right? Like we go and walk up and down rivers, turn over rocks, and try to catch little fish and crayfish and so on. She really loves doing that stuff. So if she's on the iPad and I say, let's do a river walk, I can't think of a single time. In fact, we went today, right? I can't think of a single time when she didn't want a river walk over an iPad. So you just have to find ways that you're more enjoyable than an iPad. All right. Somebody says, I think faith and first principles are technically identical in their function. I think the only difference between me and an atheist is this regard is that I accept my faith and they're in denial of theirs. Is there a good argument against that? Science doesn't exist without its methodology. Its methodology doesn't exist without philosophy. Philosophers have to make first principle assumptions about everything to say they can know anything. LOL. I'm probably too dumb to ask the question properly. I'll let God sort that out. Yeah, so this is the idea that people say, well, I have faith in God, but you have faith in reason. But no, I don't have faith in reason, because reason is not something whose truth I need to accept without evidence. Reason is based on the essential properties of matter, and to some degree energy, but in particular of matter, right? If you think of Aristotle's three laws of logic, A is A, an object is itself. A is either A or non-A. A can't be both A and non-A at the same time. This is just stuff we all learn as kids, right? We learn that a ball is a ball. We learn that it continues to be a ball. We can't snap our fingers and turn it into candy, and Lord knows we've probably tried as kids to some degree or another. So reason is valid because it describes the basic properties of matter and energy, that matter and energy is not self-contradictory, that an object is itself. An object is either itself or something else or nothing. And an object cannot be both itself and something else or nothing at the same time, right? So if you're a kid and you're supposed to give a kid three pieces of candy and you give him two pieces of candy, you can't say that's three pieces of candy, because the kid's going to say, no, that's two, one, two, where's the third, right? So you don't have to have faith in reason, because reason is derived from the stable, universal, and consistent properties of matter. So, whereas God is not. So, it's not faith. Somebody asks, you've embraced AI to help promote and expand your work in the last year or so. Have you had a chance to use it to challenge your own beliefs and philosophical theories, or to point out any potential flaws in your thinking or anything like that? Have you actively debated it about anything? If so, what was your experience? How do you feel about AI overall, and where do you see it going? This is not your fault. I'm just telling you like a sort of minor irritation that I have about things like, well, Steph, you've been doing philosophy for 40 years. Have you ever challenged your own beliefs? It's like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? The whole point of philosophy is to challenge your assumptions. I've openly said, though of course I'm not expecting everyone to have heard every show, but I've openly talked about how I was mostly an Aristotelian / objectivist for the first 20 years of my philosophical journey, and only after 20 years did I find that I had something of significant value to offer philosophy in the expansion of its methodology, and after that, right? So I'm talking about universally preferable behavior, my rational proof of secular ethics, and a lot of other things that I've talked about, some of which I've talked about in this actual show. And so when you say, have you had a chance to use it to challenge your own beliefs or philosophical theories? When I have been challenged I've done tons of debates. I've had people call in to disagree with me. I'm engaged in debates with people about their history, choices, circumstances, and free will all the time, and moral responsibility in my call-in shows. So what on earth would AI have to offer me that I haven't already gotten from 20 years and from 40 years, really, of being opposed, right? So when I started getting into philosophy, I was a socialist, and I had to challenge that. When I started getting into philosophy, my friends generally were collectivists and mystics or subjectivists, and I had to be challenged by that and had to debate that. Of course, I was on the debate team in high school. I was on the debate team in university. I had to fight a lot with largely leftist and collectivist professors and so on, right? I had to fight in theater school about the definition of art and its purpose, because for them, art and its purpose was generally the promotion of leftist political ideals, like sort of Mother Courage and Her Children, Brecht kind of stuff. And the purpose of art was activism, whereas for me, the purpose of art is the exposure of moral truths and their consequences. So I've had, 40 years of, massive amounts of opposition. And, after 40 years of massive amount of opposition and self-criticism, I've got a whole series of videos called I Was Wrong About, sort of X, Y, and Z. I've made apologies where I've gotten things incorrect and was too hasty in my judgments and so on. So the idea that AI would do more than 40 years of massive opposition and flourishing and surviving through all of that, I think AI is a very good tool. It's a very interesting tool. I think for automated pseudo-intellectual tasks, it can be fine. But as far as it coming up with new ideas and theories and so on, anything truly useful that AI comes up with will just be censored anyway. So, all right. How to accept aging gracefully? Well, the best way to accept aging gracefully is to promote virtue and fight evil over the course of your life. Otherwise, you're wasting your time in brutal, selfish hedonism. The purpose of our lives is to promote virtue and fight evil, to promote virtue and oppose immorality, to promote reason and oppose mysticism, violence, manipulation, neglect, gaslighting, you know, all of the sophist Lord of the Rings ring style trickery that people use to baffle and control other people's minds and therefore the resources of their calloused hands. So how do you accept aging gracefully? I mean, I just turned 58, so I hope I have some reasonable thoughts about this, but the way that you accept aging gracefully is you look back in satisfaction at the virtue you have promoted and the vices you have opposed, both within yourself and, of course, in particular, in the world, since philosophy is about the world, not just about you or me or any particular individual. So I, of course, look back upon my life at my, at this point, 43-year promotion of virtue and fighting of immorality, and I've done as much as I can possibly do. I've taken as many risks as I can reasonably take and survive, and I have done as much as I possibly can to promote a virtue and to discourage vice. And I have received both, you know, massive social attacks and amazing and wonderful positives. So I have spent my scant time on this planet using, and this is straight out of Aristotle, right? That the expansion of moral excellence, the pursuit of moral excellence is the best way to spend our lives. To be fully human is to manifest that which is the most human about us. And what is the most human about us is morality, because it's something that the animals don't have. They have loyalty, they have pair bonding, they have bonding, so to speak, but it's not morality, right? What we have is morality. So the degree to which we accept, review, understand, and promote morality is the degree to which we are most fully human. And I, without a doubt, have done as much as I can and worked as hard as I can to promote virtue and fight immorality, oppose immorality. You know, as I talked about in a show recently, and in a practical, measurable way, right? I talked about this in a show recently. I've done probably 1.5 billion reductions of violations of the non-aggression principle, just in terms of spanking, has arisen out of my show. So I enjoy aging, because I look back over the course of my life and I say, boy, look at all the good I've done. Look at all the good I've done. Look at all the immorality I prevented, minimized, opposed, or encouraged people to not even manifest in the first place. So do good, have a good conscience, fight immorality intelligently, right? I mean, the analogy to wartime is that philosophy is always engaged in a war of anti-propaganda, not of open violence, right? Or, you know, I oppose the use of violence, of course, except in an extremity of immediate self-defense. So how do you accept aging gracefully? Well, do good, oppose immorality, and you will enjoy aging, because that's the best use of your time that you can possibly have, and it is the most human. Of course, you know, you can remember, what was it, Da Vinci, or I think it was Da Vinci who said, I dislike aging, but it sure beats the alternative. Knowing you're going to die and reminding yourself that you're going to die helps put your troubles in perspective and helps you take the risks necessary to promote virtue. All right. Last question. You're the best. Well, that's not really a question. That's a statement. Look, I appreciate that. That's very kind, and I don't want to sort of brush that off as if that's irrelevant, but the philosophy that I generate, articulate, and provide to the world, in particular for free, the philosophy that I generate, articulate, and provide to the world is really good. It's really good in terms of its excellence. It's also really good in terms of its morality. So I can't imagine, I think it was Da Vinci also who said that when he got older, he regretted that he'd put so little used to the talents that God gave him. And that was always kind of a chilling thing to me, right? Which is why I've written, you know, I don't know, 24 books, and I've got like close to 6,000 podcasts, 3 documentaries, you know, both fiction and nonfiction. I've written a bunch of poetry, and I've just really tried to use the gifts that I've been given in the most benevolent and helpful way to the world as a whole. I did not earn these gifts, and therefore I have to earn my pride in the gifts. And since I didn't earn my gifts of intelligence and eloquence and so on, since I didn't earn these gifts, I have to earn pride in using them in the best and most moral possible way. And I would really suggest that you try this in your own life. It is the only path, really, to sustained happiness and all of that. So when you say you're the best, I appreciate that. That's very kind, and I certainly have done some things to earn that. But really, it is about the philosophy that I bring to bear on the world that is really good, really helpful, really positive, and has changed the lives of millions around the world with your support and help, which I am very humbly grateful for. freedomain.com/donate. Have yourself a joyous, wonderful day. Lots of love from up here. I'll talk to you soon.